Tonight we're on lesson number 18, page number 55 in the lesson book. And pick up at Acts chapter 6, verse 8, all the way through Acts chapter 8, verse 1, the first part of the verse. A and a B means one's first part, B means the second part. We won't get that all the way. I don't expect we'll get all the way through it tonight, but it was kind of fun, you know, doing this, working a history lesson more or less tonight. But many times whenever they're presenting the gospel of Christ, you'll see that when they're talking to the Jews, they often do a history lesson. And if you think about it, it makes sense of why that's necessary or why they do that and that it is convincing to those folks. Is, you know, as we get into tonight's lesson and look at the why that Stephen would do such a thing, it's really to establish what you're saying, because they were familiar with the Old Testament scriptures and these stories and these events. I don't like calling them stories, because stories can be true or false, and I don't want to give the impression that these are false or could be fables, because they're not. We have them as a record of history. Even in secular history, we have some of these events. So these are things that really did happen. There's proof beyond the Bible that they did happen. And, of course, that's becomes a tenet of our belief. As our custom has been, let us read at least part of the text over. So we'll just read Acts chapter 6, 8 through the end of the chapter. Does anybody want to volunteer to read?
In Jenny's turn.
Whoever's turn.
Where do you want me to go?
Verse 8, chapter 6.
Eight? Okay.
Yep, read to the end of the chapter. All right, and that conclude our reading for the evening. Question?
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
I try to be loud.
Question number one, what did Stephen begin to do?
Great wonders and miracles.
Great wonders and miracles. How did he have this ability to do this? Yep, they had hands laid on them. They had miraculous power because of this. The second part of the question, is there any record of anyone performing miracles in the church except the apostles before this time?
Yeah.
I don't believe there is, or at least it's not recorded for us. And I'm not sure if that's significant or not, but
before the Great Commission?
It specifically says in the church, so it'd have to be from the establishment of the church until this time.
Yeah, before, yes, because Jesus sent out 70 other people in addition to the 12 apostles to gave them power to, you know, cast out devils and do all the other things. But
that predates the church.
Yeah, that predates the church, so that doesn't really fit the biblical question. So.
Maybe why I asked that question, because I wouldn't have thought to... Because I wouldn't have thought about that question. Sometimes I read stuff like this, it makes me wonder, am I not curious enough? You know. Number two, name at least four groups that rose against Stephen.
Phoenicians,
mm-hmm.
Alexandrians, Phoenicians, Asians.
Yep. I figured somebody would list the Libertines, but that's representing a group of people. I'm surprised I didn't have a question about that, about the Libertines. Does anyone know who the Libertines were? Or what that temple represented, I guess?
There was a group of people at that time who considered themselves free men or set at liberty.
Well, in fact, the New King James Version calls it the synagogue of the freed men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they put the definition there. Like you were saying, the Libertines were a group of captives captives of Rome under Pompey, but were afterwards set free. And although they had fixed their abode in Rome, they had built their own, out of their own expenses, built their own temple or synagogue at Jerusalem, and which some believe they frequented in that city, and hence the name the Libertines, to assign that they were freed. But most of these folks, from what I understand, were free-born Jews who had subsequently taken up residence in Rome. And so it's an interesting thing there. That was as far as the name of the temple goes. Notice that these people that were mentioned, these four groups of people that rose against Stephen, this was, we might say, this was a diverse group that were there. These were people, you know, a native of Cyrene, or Cyrene, and the Alexandrians, obviously, and from Alexandria, and which would have been people that I would expect to be of Alexandria, Egypt, perhaps. So that's another group, you know, from another type region. Then, of course, Asia. Yeah, that'd be a whole area, I guess we could say. But if you look at a Bible map, there'll be areas that they call Asia, large areas that contain several different countries. But it's not the same Asia, the same areas we call Asia today. They broke it up into Asia, Asia Minor, and different things if you look at an old biblical map. But it's still the same area. I mean, the area we call Asia today, the continent we call Asia, encompasses all these areas. We left one out. Cilicia, which is considered the region, the other part is talking about region of Asia Minor. And, of course, it's Cilicia is equivalent to what you can find in some works as the land of Seleucus. It's the same area. Question number two, or three, or no, we still got one part of that question, haven't we? What does disputing mean?
To argue about something, you can discuss it cheaply, you can compete for it, you can strive to win.
Sometimes it even carries with it the idea of contending, as Jude talks about in Jude 3 and 4, to earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered to the saints. And that carries with it the idea of legal speech. And so to earnestly contend for the faith, which is what Stephen did on his part anyway, they may have been disputing, he was contending. He was abiding lawful in his obedience to Christ here. So,
well, if you think about Paul, what was he accused of on more than one occasion? He was opening and alleging. This is kind of the same kind of thing. You're presenting evidence so that you can examine it together. And of course, opposing sides, that's where the dispute comes in. And they were seeking or to examine the information together, what he was saying. Question number three, what did they do when they found themselves unable to resist Stephen's wisdom? Yep. Yeah, this word suborned here, this nice strong King James word, old English word that I'm sure you've used many times in your life outside of Bible study.
it's a poor phrase because it talks about suborning perjury.
That's right. So it's still used a little bit. But this, according to Thayer's Bible Dictionary, is to induce or give false testimony. Remember, this is carrying on the idea of false testimony. And so they had encouraged him to do this. We'll read about this happening more than once in the book of Acts. We'll read it. Actually, it happened several times. And it's interesting because we still experience what Stephen experienced here today. Maybe not as much in this country, but we have in other countries. One of our friends, or became our friends, actually preached after he got through in Russia. He come preached to my home congregation 5-6 years. And one of his kids is fixing to go to Tanzania for, I don't know, a 5-year commitment or something like that. But he tells this really, really interesting story about them setting their building on fire while they were in it. And he said, this is what they done. So the priest, which actually probably fits another story in Acts a little bit better, but it's the same type thing. He said that the priest, Greek Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox Church got together and they went up and down the street and suborned men to come and take them out and beat them because of what they were teaching. And the reason they were getting upset, one of the reasons they were getting upset is they had recently gotten permission to, get this, a communist country, or socialist country rather, that has a state religion, and somehow you have gotten permission to bring something odd to them in Christianity, or I call it the Jesus form of Christianity. And so they was upset about that. So he said they went up down the street, got all these people riled up one Sunday when they was all there. And so they had locked the door. So they was beating on the door trying to get in. So they started to set the building on fire. So they was trying to light it up. They was getting rid of this band of Christians that met together. They didn't like it. You know, it was getting to be they'd started the church and it was getting to be a good sized group. And so he said, I was ready to fight. Because I told them, I said, let's go out there and fight them. So let's open these doors and let's just fist it out. And I said, he was that guy. And someone said, no, let's don't do it. Let's pray about it. Let's calm down. Let's pray about it and see what happens. And he said, while they were praying, said the awfulest storm you ever seen in your life came. Said it was a torrential downpour. And said it ruined their plan, got them all wet, and they couldn't get the building set on fire for the rain. And said they all broke up and went home. We see a similar thing happening here. They got people riled up, ready to do something about it. Let's kill this guy. Let's do, well, they didn't at this point not kill him, but let's do something with this guy. So question number four says, they accused him of speaking blasphemous words by saying what two things?
Against Moses and against God.
And also against this whole place in the law.
Okay, what about verse 14? Yep, because that's what they specifically say, even though both the Moses answer is right. They're both in there, but it's almost like they told two stories about them blaspheming. Because the suborned men got the one, and then before the magistrates there, they told the other one, verse 14, or the council, they told what we read in verse 14. And if you think about it, it makes sense of why this was irritating to them in a big way. Because we're talking about Jews here that did not accept Christ. Even though some of them, as we've seen in the previous chapter, were witnesses. Were witnesses of Jesus, they still didn't believe. Refused him, did not want to believe. And so remember that as we left last week, what was one of the things that was happening? They were setting the city. The information was getting across the city. People were becoming believers. And not only that, people were, this was a growing movement. So they're like, we got to stomp this out. We got to get rid of this. So here we see another attempt. No further than we are in the book of Acts. Another attempt to stomp it out. It's funny, it does. I don't like change. That's why I usually put up with things a little longer than I should, like a job or something like that. But at the same time, we're constantly changing. It's almost like a, you know, something that doesn't make sense. You know, we don't like changing our patterns, or a lot of people don't.
Preachers and habits.
Yeah, we like habits.
Every time we do it.
Yep.
And it's a big headache, and you're going to learn new jobs. And when you get used to a routine and you get good at those jobs, it's rough because you got to give up that old knowledge. And, you know,
yep.
The only thing we might keep running them for is for, like, service parts or something. You know? But as far as...
See, we like it when y'all change because that means we get more work.
Oh, yeah.
Get facility work, get all that stuff up and running.
Well, I got to share something Dad told me one time. Because, you know, I was like a creature of habit, you know. And when you change things, like what Timothy's saying, I would revert back to the old way. I forget the new and go back to the old. But, you know, he told me one time, he said, and this has really helped me. He said, you have got to start embracing change. And every time that I run up against something that's changing, and I feel like I'm having a problem that I think about. You must embrace change.
One of the biggest changes we had was Grandma's place in 2010. Because we know that was the year of the flood. They got the flood and a tornado at the same time. We didn't get that stuff here. And so Aunt Willie's house had four walnut trees that probably two people couldn't reach around, throwed across it, just mashed it. And then we lost the barn. We lost a whole bunch of buildings and things and timber, and it still don't look right. Still looks like a nuclear explosion went off up and down that holler valley. I mean, it's looking better, but I mean, it's been 10 years, but, you know, and so we got all, it took months and months to clean all that up. We ended up taking the barn down because it didn't want to rebuild it. And same thing with Aunt Willie's house. It ended up getting burned and all that. And you talk about upsetting some folks. They're like, oh, y'all just changed everything. It's like, didn't have a choice. Storm did it. And so change is just, that's just part of who we are. That's part of life.
It's not easy for somebody to change religiously, especially too, because especially if you've been brought up a certain way. I saw this with the Baptist preacher I grew up listening to. When I contended with him about talk to the Baptist preacher I grew up listening to about why baptism is essential to salvation and certain other things, he was basically telling me, I've been preaching this for too long. I grew up with this. This is a part of my upbringing. And I've been he's basically saying he's set in his ways and he's not willing to change. And when you quote scripture, like, except a man be born of the water and the spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. And they just openly say, I disagree with that. No, expounding on or explaining of it, just me quoting a scripture and him just openly saying, I don't agree with that.
Yep.
It's like, well, how can you disagree with what Jesus said? It's because they're set in their way.
The same thing we see playing out here.
And the implications sometimes, if they're wrong, sometimes we don't think about the implications of what people are thinking about when they're having that type of discussion with you. But if they are wrong about what they're preaching and teaching, that means they've been leading people astray. And they have to fix a mountain of error. And not only that, loved ones, family, could be lost because of their impact in their life. And so it's a mountain to overcome. It's like climbing Mount Everest. It's not easy. It's doable, but it's not easy.
Yeah. And that's
being part of the reason God so long suffering.
I think so. Yeah, he knows it's going to take some time for some folks, if ever. I've run into Baptist preacher, and he was just, yeah, he was sitting there just squalling.
With more years past, I understand a little bit more why there's such a hesitation it's like Jesus said, no man puts a piece of new garment to an old, lest the new tear the old. Or the same thing with wineskins. No man puts new wine into old wineskins because they're already stretched. So it'll burst them if you do that.
Yeah, they'll mess up on you.
He gave those analogies to help people understand that people weren't going to be immediately receptive to the new things he was teaching.
Well, old Baptist preacher, he was just squalling. He goes, I can't change. That means that mom and daddy will be lost. And grandma and grandpa. Like, it is what it is. I mean, you can't. They had their chance. Sounds kind of harsh to say it that way, but I mean, that's. You look at Jesus, didn't beat around the bush on stuff like that.
Have faith in God and His.
Yeah, have faith in God.
And do what you know is right based on the truth you've learned. How about that? You know, people don't think about that sometimes, but.
One more saying, like, you said your dad said that. Well, when at my first job second job in engineering, I was a ripe old age of probably 21, and we had to go through the software update. When we went to Windows 95, tells how long ago that was. So this had been probably 96 or so, And so I was the last one. I was refusing to do it. And I had this woman that was probably in her upper 40s, early 50s, somewhere around in there at that time, walk up to me and says, you're awful young to be set in your ways. Like, oh.
Man,
she got me. She got me. Oh, yeah. So ever since then, that changed my thinking on that. Well, I would like to hope that I would have found the truth somewhere, but there's so many religions out there that don't encourage you to read the Bible. There's even a few out there that don't want you to own a copy, other than put it on a coffee table. And I think there's a reason behind that. They'd lose followers, whether they realize it or not. Mm-hmm.
Reformation.
So where are we on? We're on question five. What was the appearance of Stephen's face?
Mm-hmm.
face of an angel. So when I read that, I said, I wonder if it was the face of, my thought was the face of innocence.
And the face of a messenger.
And the face of a messenger. There you go, face of a messenger. Yeah, because he faces this head on. Didn't back up. Nothing. Let's do this. what I find interesting about... I'll discuss that in a minute. Question number 6 is, in this chapter, Stephen gives a brief history from the calf to... Yes, ma'am.
There's one before that.
Oh, there is. What question did the high priest ask him? Are these things so? That's like sick 'em, dog. I mean, really, think about it. Somebody being inquisitive like that, I've told you the story about the time the girl asked me, who is Jesus? And I was so overcome with the excitement, I almost couldn't say anything for a minute because I'd never been asked that question before. And
you had one on the
hook, right? Yeah, had somebody curious because, where we live, I think it's becoming less and less, but there was a time in this country you had to hunt for somebody that didn't know who Jesus was and have the correct opinion of him. And, of course, I think that's changed now. That was excitement. I just see this right now when he asks, are these things so? He's like, let's do this. We're ready. And so here it begins. His discussion begins to let them know these things are so. Question number 6. In this chapter, Stephen gives a brief history from the call of Abraham to the time of Solomon. The questions that follow will ask you to list certain things about individuals as they relate to the overall picture. So the first group of questions is about Abraham and starts out verse 2. Where was the dwelling place?
Mesopotamia.
And the command received. Get out of the country. What was the next dwelling place?
Kind of on the northwest end of the Fertile Crescent.
The third dwelling place. I'm not sure how's the proper way to say it. Charon's what I've always said. I'm not sure that's right.
Hey, what did you say?
Charon.
Oh, with
a
C?
Haran.
Which one are we looking at?
What are y'all talking about?
Number 5, that. Verse 5.
Yeah, he...
Did I miss one?
Well, there was Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran.
Yeah.
And he said, get out of your country and from your kindred, which is... in Mesopotamia, Ur of the Chaldees. And then he came and dwelt in Haran, which is where his father Terah died, as we all know. And then...
came out of the land of the Chaldeans.
And so the second dwelling place of Abraham was Haran. But the third place would be the land of the Canaanites, because that's where he went next. Yeah. Is that what it's...
Where you now dwell. Huh?
I said, in the country where you're now living.
Yes. Number 5, the promise.
And to give him land and his seed after him, give them land also?
Yep, the promise was they would inherit it. And his descendants are his seed. And then number 6, the strange land where his seed would sojourn.
Egypt.
And the covenant he received. Covenant of circumcision. So, in this brief history of Abraham there, just a second. In this brief history we have here of Abraham, you have to go back to the book of Genesis to find this, to find where God has made the seed land promise. What I like about what he's doing is he's building the argument leading up to Christ. These, you've got to remember, this council that was there, or you know, would have known these things. And so he's been accusing of perverting this story. And so now it seems to me that he's saying, this is what we're teaching. He's showing it to them. This is part of the dispute. And I can just see them sitting there at this point saying, yep, don't see anything wrong with this. Then we get to the second part, Joseph. Yes, sir. Okay. What's the question? Yes. You said how is it? How was that fulfilled? That yeah, I believe. No. Yeah, this is where one of the things that I think people get confused about today is they look at it kind of the same way that the Jews of that day and time, some of them did look at it. It was only for them and only for their descendants, blood descendants, and discounting the fact that we are all part of the spiritual Israel. We're all spiritual Jews because of Christ. Not because of necessarily a direct bloodline descendant of one of those. And also, I think people forget about the historical event that's going to happen a few years after this writing, of where God says it's done. And, you know, we don't have it in the Bible per se, that, you know, the events of, we have the prophecy, but the events of AD 70, approximately whenever Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was destroyed, and it's been no more. So that got rid of all the records. It got rid of all the information that where you could be a blood descendant all the way back to Abraham. Okay. You couldn't prove it.
Yeah.
You had no proof.
AD 70, nobody living today can truly claim they're a Jew.
That's right. They can't prove
it. Truly. They are all Samaritans. Because of their hatred and the way they treated Samaritans when they should have been a blessing to Samaritans, which were some of their relatives. Because the Samaritans were half Jews that came back from Babylonian exile and couldn't prove their lineage. Well, Jesus is about to do that to all of them. Stamping out that fleshly pride once and for all. And they have no clue what's coming. They don't understand it. And Stephen's speech here starts with, here's the message that originally came to the man who was called of God. Get out from your country and from your kindred. Don't you think there's something that should resonate with them on that? Jesus is calling us
out
from among the nations. And this included the Jews. At this point, as the chapter's already pointed out, or chapter 6 has already pointed out, a lot of the priests, a great many of the priests, had become obedient to the faith. That should have been a telltale sign. These are the people that study the law. These are people that are supposed to be a blessing of knowledge and a source of knowledge to other people. And guess what? They've been persuaded. Maybe there's something to this. They're beholding his face as it's the face of an angel. And then he's recounting history and throughout all of this. And the reason why Brother Johnny, he didn't mention the Genesis 22 promise is because it hasn't yet come to pass at this point in his recounting. That's a later promise that Abraham laid hold on when he offered up his only begotten son. When he offered up his only begotten son, he became the descendant through which Jesus would take on his lineage. He became that person, that patriarch, through whom Jesus would come once he offered up his son. If he hadn't done that, that's an additional promise. People miss that sometimes. They don't differentiate between all the promises. God made a promise when he first called him out. If you'll leave your country and get out from your kindred, I will bring you to a land, and your descendants after you will inherit that land. Well, once he offered up his son, there was something else added in. I will bless those that bless you. I will curse those that curse you. And your seed, Christ, would possess the gate of his enemies. That's the gates of hell, which shall not prevail against my church, as he said. Genesis 22 is Matthew 16:18.
Mm-hmm.
And people miss it all the time. And then he's about to get into Joseph and Moses. And here's two men on their first appearance with, or their first encounter with their brethren. They reject these leaders. But their second appearance, they're made known. They didn't recognize Jesus at his first coming, but at his second coming, they're going to recognize it. There's so much spiritual teaching in here that people miss when they read through this, that they don't see the many things that Stephen is implying. They don't see the, because there's so much.
Well, you got to remember, too, yes, that who he's speaking to. He's speaking to people that's probably well-educated.
Yeah. They're too educated. They're so full of themselves, they can't hear anything new.
Yeah,
they can't learn anything.
They can't learn from what they know, from the knowledge. It's made them mad, as the saying is. He's building this argument up to Christ.
It shows the church. Because Abraham's made the promise of many descendants, but he first has to offer up his only son. Parallel that with God. He offers up his only son, and what does he get out of it? Bringing many sons to glory, as Hebrews chapter 2 talks about. So yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful fulfillment if you parallel it all. It's not easy to, because there's so much.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in there.
But, okay, like on Acts chapter 7, verse 5, and it says, and he gave him none inheritance in it, no, not so much as to set his foot on, yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no children. So, that's where I was pulling mine from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, Abraham never set foot in the promised land.
Well, he sojourned there, but he didn't own it. Until his wife Sarai died, he didn't own anything.
Anything. That's right.
And then after she died, he he bought the cave of Machpelah from the sons of,
wasn't the sons of Haran, was it?
Sons of Heth.
Heth, yeah.
Sons of Heth, he bought that burying place, and they offered it to him freely, and he's like, no, I will not bury my wife somewhere where I'm not paid for.
Yep.
So he wanted to be considered the true owner. So see, like, they would have treated it in time to come as, you know, well, we let you borrow temporarily, but this is actually our land. So he bought it. But this, that's not the fulfillment of the promise, because purchasing land is not the promise of being given land. And there's a distinction there. Just like there's a distinction between Sarah offering Hagar, his wife, you know, for a child to fulfill the promise. That wasn't the son of promise. Ishmael was not the fulfillment. The fulfillment was of Sarah, your wife. That was the promise seed. So trying to make something happen to fulfill the promise, that doesn't fulfill it. God keeping his promise, however, does.
Does fulfill it, yep.
And what's so great about this verse 5 is it speaks volumes about Abram's faith. Because as yet, he's just a sojourner. He doesn't own the land. He has no children yet. And yet he has left his homeland. He has given up his former life. And he is leaning upon God's promises with not much evidence of it going to be fulfilled as yet.
So would you
he's
say
trusting in God.
So would you say he was embracing change?
Yes. He was the chief of change, because they got up and left, you know.
You might say he's one of the truest believers in all the Bible. One of the purest
believers. It comes across as he just blindly believed God said, let's do it. He did it.
Childlike faith is Patriarch Abraham.
That's right. Example for us all.
There's another example for us all. Have you ever thought about why God asked him to leave where he was as a king?
Hadn't put a lot of thought into it.
Because they were idolatrous worshipers.
Yeah, the evil was what I was, would have been my answer.
Because of that, well,
that's, if you think about it, many times when God has asked people to vacate areas, a lot of times it's been because of evil around them. Or, in the case of some, it's been because he's got a better plan for them that would be a future blessing. Letter B, Joseph, his father, his protector, his enemies, and the event that gave him opportunity to help his family, and the number of his kinsmen that came to Egypt.
3 score and 15 souls, which is 75 people.
Yep, 75, and the reason the children of Israel began to be treated cruelly.
They multiplied greatly.
New king didn't know Joseph, and the Israelites multiplied until they outnumbered the Egyptians.
Yep, they were not. Another king arose who knew not Joseph. That, to me, that's a thing we witness a lot in business, especially. You have the founders of a business, and they, you know, the people that run it for a while, you know, they shook hands with them, they worked with them, they're protective of the business, and then when everybody retires or dies off and gone, then they're interested. A lot of times it'll last a while, and then it ends up getting sold, or something bad happens because they forgot, the leadership forgot how they got there. This idea, or this was Joseph. You know, one of the patriarchs. And the beauty of that story is God is all over it. He's all through that story the whole time, protecting him, causing his purpose to be played out in him. Notice that in the story of Joseph, we see that God preserves his people through using the nation of Egypt. Because when the famine hit, when the great dearth or the famine hit, Egypt was prepared. Most of the nations were not prepared because they didn't know it was coming. God revealed that to them, that this was coming up. And he used Joseph to bless Egypt, but at the same time, that's how he was able to preserve his people. And as we've been reading on Sunday night in our scripture reading, you know, we just finished up that story more or less of how that come about or come to pass. But was it easy for Joseph? Absolutely not. It was rough. It was rough for him because, you know, the story with Potiphar's wife and him getting thrown in prison and, you know, and so on and so forth. If it hadn't been for God protecting him, he wouldn't have made it. He wouldn't have made it there. And his brothers, you know, selling him into that slavery, you know, that just seems like just something terrible that, you know, brothers or family members would do to other family members. Would you sell off your two brothers? Oh, I thought he was going to say yes and grin, you know. I don't know. I got a couple of sisters I might sell. I don't know. But what I like about that story is God being the protector. We see God's hand all through that story, making sure things were happening that his purpose would be accomplished, even though another king arose who knew not Joseph. Well, I guess we're out of time. I didn't really. We'll pick up with Moses next week. We may go back to say some more about Joseph here next week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then the other one was C-H-A-L-D-A-E-N, right?
No, the third one was the land of which you dwell.
The land of the Canaan.
Yeah, the land of the Chaldeans. What verse? Number four. See, notice it says he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Charan or Charan. No, the land you dwell in now, which would be the land of Canaan.
So you got Chaldean first, Quran second, and then Canaan third. All seas.
All seas. Yeah, the Mesopotamia there is an area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then Canaan.
Yep, CCC. Anything else?
Well, there's a lot.
Well, yeah, I didn't realize it was
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.